After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
I think Sotni's brilliance is in seeing that meditation practice, instead of being a place to hide from these things, can be a place where you deal with them.
Right. Why we meditate.
Yeah, that's there one good go. Reason.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu back with Mind Rolling with a very old friend, Danny Goldman. Danny, welcome.
Raghu, it's always a pleasure to do anything with you.
Same here. We've known each other an awfully long time. We were in
Much
India
too
together.
Long. Yes. Maybe 50 years.
Over. Yeah.
Don't
over.
Think about it.
Yeah. And I was thinking about that, actually. Well, first of all, Danny, for those of you, Danny's been on Mind Rolling and over the years. And what I wanted to do today was highlight a book that came out last year that Danny and Sokhni Rinpoche, a great meditation teacher, wrote together. And somehow I had just come across it in the last month or so. And then I got a copy and I was like, wow, okay, we got to talk about this. Because what I try and do here with this podcast is really give people a chance to have information that just really helps balance them on a day-to-day basis and brings them more into unity. Mm. And this has chock full of great, great information, teachings, and so on. Of course, Danny is... back in the day, was a New York Times science writer, right? You were writing.
Correct.
And has written many books, particularly, and I still go ahead and say to people, get Emotional Intelligence, okay, Danny's book, because it is extremely efficacious for helping all of us on that subject, because we all have that issue, one way or the other.
We all have emotions, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. And so, anyhow, but Danny, I was thinking about when we came back from India, way back in the day, the image appeared in my mind. Mm. Somehow, we ended up at my father's horse farm, just over the Vermont border in Quebec, where I'm from, Montreal. And we, with our partners, there was three couples, we all decided, okay, so we'll stay here for the summer. And so what we did was we moved everything out of that house because my father had gone to India to be with Neem Karoli Baba, with Maharaji. And we moved everything out. We were living on the floor because we were trying to recreate. We didn't want to lose that India vibe, so we recreated it here, in that farmhouse. Actually, you remember those days? My God,
I remember. In fact, my oldest son was born at that farm.
That's right. We had Govinda. Several babies born. Yeah, Govindos.
And then, which made him a Canadian citizen, which is cool.
Oh, he still got that duel, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. And my other recollection that appeared to me in brilliant color, another of our satsang who was there, Mirabai Bush.
Sure.
And she was having a baby as well. And in the middle of it, oh my God, this baby is Breach. What do, and the I guess the nursemaid or whatever doula could not come. It was just us in the room, and I'm sure you remember this going, okay, well, we have to get the Chicago manual, fireman's manual about how to deliver a baby. And there's you, Danny, sitting there reading and instructing John Bush, the husband, on what to do to turn that baby around.
It was kind of crazy. What had happened was that because my then wife, Anasuya, had no problem having a home birth, Mirabai, months later, thought, well, I'll do it too. She had gone to a local obstetrician who actually saw that it was Breech birth, but didn't say anything because he assumed he'd be handling it in the hospital. But instead, we foolish young hippies were having a home delivery. And Breech birth is a very high-risk birth, even in a hospital. But miraculously, Owen to this day is just fine. And he has a child of his own. So I think it was successful.
It all worked out.
Miraculously.
Yeah, but we were something. I mean, talk about either very courageous and a little bit dumb at the same time. Right?
I would say kids don't try this at home.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely not. Anyhow, so when I said, I think before we got on, you know, I was able to familiarize myself a little bit more with Tsoknyi Rinpoche, great teacher. And I know others of us in our Neem Karoli Baba satsang have taken teachings from him. Yes. I didn't quite know how far back you go with him, but I think, you know, it'd be great if you could just tell the listeners just what this family is about with the Tulku Urgyen,
well,
starting there.
Yes, and I actually met Tsoknyi Rinpoche the day he came to America. I was attending a retreat that was put together by another member of our satsang, Suryadas. Ramdas came, and it was at a Zen center that he had rented in the Catskills. Tsoknyi flew in because he wanted to get some teachings from the Lama that Surya had brought there, named Nyosho Ken. Nyosho Ken was a very famous, very highly evolved Lama. And Tsoknyi became a friend from that time on. I then started arranging retreats for him in America. And he came, you mentioned his family. His family is extraordinary. His father, Tulku Urgyen Rinpoche, was one of the most renowned meditation masters to come out of Tibet. And he had four sons, each of whom are recognized reincarnations or tulkus, one of them being Tsoknyi Rinpoche, another being Chokyi Nyima Rinpoche, who I've also studied with, who's remarkable. Still another is Mingyur Rinpoche, who has a fantastic program, online program. And then Choling Rinpoche, who recently passed away.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Son, yeah, his son Pakchok has become a teacher in his own right. So there's something going on in that family. I don't know what, but it's pretty remarkable. Tsoknyi has become a very close friend. He's visited with us pretty much every year for a long time. And I had done a book with another friend, Richard Davidson, who's a neuroscientist at Wisconsin, where we reviewed all the main findings on meditation. That book is called Altered Traits. And I gave a talk on that at Tsoknyi Rinpoche's invitation at a retreat. And he said, you know what? Afterward, he said, this would be a great book to put together meditation instruction, which he provided for our book, Why We Meditate, with some of the scientific findings, which I provided. And that's the book you have today, Why We Meditate. It's really how to meditate.
I have a comment about that. But I want to say to everybody out there, there's a, it It's a biography, autobiography, I think, of Tulku Urgen Rinpoche, Brilliant Splendor, is that
Blazing
it?
Splendor.
Blazing Splendor.
It's a book I edited, actually. Now, this is interesting. In that tradition, humility is a great virtue. And the more evolved you are, the more humble you are. So Tulku Urgen's longtime translator, Erik Pemmekundson, who's a Danish guy, said to Tulku Urgen, you know, I think we'd like to write your biography. And that's a tradition in Tibetan lineages. And Tulku Urgen says, oh, I have no accomplishment. There's nothing to write about. I've done nothing interesting in my life. But Erik was very clever. He said, well, then tell me about the masters you met in Tibet. He said, oh, I can do that. So the book Blazing Splendor is really Tulku Urgen's account of the masters in his family, starting with the first Trolling Rinpoche, who was what's called a finder of termas, of lost teachings. He founded a lineage, the Trolling lineage. Trolling's daughter, who I think is the grandmom of Tulku Urgen, she was a great meditator. Her sons, who were teachers of Tulku Urgen, and many, many other amazing lamas that he knew about or met over the course of a lifetime in Tibet. It's a great book, Blazing Splendor.
Really great book for anybody. And we'll put this in the show notes so you can easily find it. But for anybody interested at all in Tibetan spirituality, if you, in the most general sense, but the combination of wisdom and humility and joy and not taking oneself too seriously, all of it is really something else. I mean, now, why we meditate? I don't know. This book, yes, it has a lot around meditation. But what struck me, and the subtitle is The Science and Practice of Clarity and Compassion. By the way, here's the book.
Thank you.
And it has so much in it dealing with the stuff we all deal with on a day-to-day basis around neurotic tendencies, habitual patterns, the perspective that we see our lives and basically fool ourselves a lot in terms of our projections and so on. I mean, it has so much of that. And, you know, I love this story Sokhni tells about he's somewhere, I forget where, maybe in Singapore or something, but he's just watching TV in his hotel room. And he sees this ad, you know, these two shiny people, you know, with a product, which turns out to be a computer, an iPad type thing, I think, you know, and he ends up getting it. And he tells the whole story of how all of this thought process got followed through by virtue of being sucked into this, you know, this commercial world. And then in the end, he takes it, I think, on a trip through some very remote place. And of course, the whole thing falls apart. It's so great, so great. Maybe you can talk a little bit about Danny. Just right at the very beginning of the book, I think he talks about how he was teaching meditation in a certain way, and he found that his students weren't really getting it. I think because they were absorbing this in a very intellectual way, and it wasn't hitting into the core of their being. Can you talk about that, Rihanna?
Yeah, actually, as he tells it, it's really a difference between the traditional Asian people he was used to teaching, Tibetans, Nepalis, and Westerners. And those who are kind of engrossed and caught up in modern life, fast pace, lots of things to do, lots of worries, lots of anxieties, lots of stress. And he realized that people in the West would do better if he would address the things that we ruminate about, the things that keep us preoccupied, the things that get in the way when we meditate. And I have to say, he, as I mentioned, he often yearly would come and stay with us for a few days. And one of the things he did, he's a voracious learner, was he talked to my wife, Tara Bennett Goldman, about a book she had written called Emotional Alchemy, which is about the most common neurotic patterns that people have. And he realized that he would do better in reaching his Western students if he addressed these habitual patterns, emotional patterns, that get in the way of our, you know, our meditation, our relationships, our lives. And so he developed, he put her thinking together with traditional Tibetan methods and came up with what he calls handshake practice. In handshake practice, you don't deny what's going on. You actually tune into it, into these kinds of patterns. And he has a method for really befriending them, which neutralizes them in effect and helps you get into meditation. So I think this was, by the way, a radical departure from the way Tibetan teachings had traditionally been given. And so from some point of view, I think it was maybe a little risky, but from another, I think it really hit home for Western students because the Tibetan teachings have traditionally started with the assumption that we're all okay, which actually turns out not to be true.
Wild understatement for us here in the West. Why do you think we have this, we could talk about a little bit, and you mentioned in the book Spiritual Bypass, which seems to be a very prevalent phenomenon here for us in the West.
And the concept of spiritual bypassing, he learned from another student of his, John Wellwood, late John Wellwood, sadly. And John saw that many people hide from their problems in meditation practice and spiritual work without facing them. And Sogmi Rinpoche thought, hey, it's really better if we just face what's going on and deal with it rather than try to hide it under the rug because it's going to come back and bite us.
Yeah, therein dealing with the psychological aspects of our lives, I think particularly in the West, is appropriate, very appropriate.
Huh? Well, he found and has found that this really helps people much more than ignoring what's going on.
But there's what I said earlier about there's some methodology here that can really help. He had one of them, maybe you can describe the dropping practice. I mean, there's a way in which...
Dropping practice, actually, which is, I think, the first practice. In the book, he shares a whole series of practices.
Yeah.
I give a science. So the practices come from his side. But dropping is a very dramatic way to start a meditation because there's a kind of physical, you raise your hand and you just let them drop to your knees. And with that, your mind clears for a second. And that opens the way to meditation instead of saying, well, now I'm going to meditate and I'm sitting on my cushion, but actually I'm bringing all of my habitual thoughts along with me. He's kind of breaking that habit right at the start.
Yeah, no, that seemed like a great thing. And of course, the breath practices, which are, getting from that center piece of our belief in the I, in our ego minds, and getting it into, well, Ram Dass called it loving awareness. I think it's really very much parallel.
Ram Dass and I, toward the end of his life, had a very deep discussion about the similarities between Tibetan practice and the notion of loving awareness. I am loving awareness, which was his mantra. And essentially, in the Tibetan tradition, it's understood that in order to be truly compassionate, to be open to other people and their needs, we need to let go of our own self-grasping, our own ego, That's a loving awareness. The awareness that lets you love is one that is not bound up by I, me, and mine. Mm. The usual thoughts that we build our self-concept out of. So a lot of Tibetan practice has to do with deconstructing, as we'd say in the West, letting go of all that, and not denying it, but not clinging to it either. Mm. Letting it come, but letting it go. Mm. And that's very important. And particularly in the cultivation of, they see that kind, what they call emptiness, which is letting go, as essential to compassion, which is being open to the needs of others.
Mm. Have you heard Krishnas, our good buddy, talk about the movie of Me? You wake up in the morning and you're the chief protagonist, yeah, and the writer and the producer, and you even write your own reviews. It's so fun what he does.
I had dinner with Krishnadas last night.
Oh, really? Oh, nice. Yeah. Yeah.
But we were in the movie of Me. We didn't talk about it.
That's so great. So the beautiful monsters. Now, do I love that expression? That is so great. But I mean, he talks about mindfulness going wrong. I mean, I thought that this was a very particularly apt insight to make, especially with us in the West, where we are so fundamentally oriented towards achievement. And what does he say? I was mindful of every thought, but didn't know what to do with them. This is when he was younger, right? Just noticing is not enough. It's good, but we need more. It's a powerful tool, but it needs to be complemented with other qualities to become balanced, to be an actual path. I learned we need loving kindness, practice, insight, and integrity. Yeah, talk about that. I mean, that's...
Well, you mentioned beautiful monsters, which is his concept. Tara in Emotional Alchemy was talking about the same patterns, but then he amplified the concept to anything that grabs us habitually, that we ruminate about, that takes us over, that keeps us from really letting go. And he calls these beautiful monsters. They're monstrous because they keep us in their grip. They become beautiful when we can make friends with them, as he puts it, which is to let them come up, say, oh, here you are again, my friend, but not be captured by them. Then you can let them go. Mm. So that's his concept, beautiful monsters.
Yeah. Ram Dass had some sideways thing around that as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he talked about his schmooze. He got the schmooze. They got down to little schmooze, from big schmooze to little schmooze, and that was all about perspective and opening up some spaciousness.
Well, you know, there's a certain generational divide here, because people born after a certain year never saw Al Capp's cartoon strip, Little Abner, which featured the schmoo.
Oh, right.
That's where Ram Dass got the notion of a schmoo. Mm. A schmoo is a little kind of bowling pin shaped being that kind of grabs you and hugs you and won't let go. And Ram Dass said, well, we all have our schmooze. And he's talking about the same kind of emotional habits, emotional patterns that we can't let go of. I think it's the same concept, just different language.
Yeah. Yeah. But everybody, we can create a friendship with these schmooze guys, beautiful monsters.
Yeah.
And it's possible. It is possible.
And the friendship is marked by being able to say, oh, here you are again. Welcome. And I don't need you, and I'm letting you go. Hmm.
Have a cup of tea maybe first before you go.
Sure, if you want.
Yeah. I think his also in his comments around in this particular chapter, but he talks about relative truth having two dimensions: functional, authentic relative truth, and distorted, deceptive relative perception. I think for everyone to have an idea of this relative to how our perspective on our lives, I think, is really important. Maybe talk about that.
What he's referring to there is actually, I think, something he got from a conversation with Tara, because she was grounded in the integration of mindfulness and cognitive therapy. She was the first to write about that. Now it's very popular. But in cognitive therapy, one of the goals is to identify the distortions in your thoughts, like nobody loves me. Mm. Well, actually, people do love you. So the nobody loves me is the relative truth, which is distorted. And the fact that actually you are lovable and people do love you and have loved you is the more realistic truth in it. So he's talking about those two aspects of relative truth. And by the way, a complicated little relative truth is contrasted in the Tibetan model with ultimate truth, which is beyond words, which is non-dual. But he's not talking about that here in the book. He's talking about the distortions that we all bring to these emotional patterns. It's and in cognitive therapy and therapy generally, they try to help us identify where our thinking is distorted and straighten it out or find a thought which is contrary to it, which is objectively true.
Yeah. Very important, because we all get so caught up in our belief system around this. To the
and,
littlest.
You know, these personal belief systems are often shaped when we're just children, and they're very hard to shape. They're lifelong. In Tara's book, Emotional Alchemy, she names the fear of abandonment, a sense of emotional deprivation that nobody empathizes with you or cares about you. These are very primal kinds of habitual patterns, and they play out in our adult relationships in different ways. So if you have fear of abandonment, you may be the first to jump out of a relationship because you're afraid that person is going to leave you. It shows up in all kinds of ways. So he's trying to help bring this to the meditation path, to a spiritual path, in the book, Why We Meditate.
Yeah. Boy, deconstructing all of that stuff from earliest to patterns that are created. Yeah. From the moment you get your name and, oh, wait, I'm a separate entity now. Right.
Oh, yeah. But here, have some conditional love. We'll love you if you do this and if you do that.
Right.
The unstated thing is we won't love you if you don't. And that shapes a child very powerfully.
Yeah. It's kind of amazing when you think about it, which is... And I always, hear His Holiness Dalai Lama talk about what is so important going forward for the world, for humans, is mothers having compassion. He said, "That's why I am." I mean, you've heard him and heard him. You've
been because of his own mother.
Yeah, because of his own mother.
Who was very loving. And what he's talking about is a certain kind of caring parenthood, I think, which then helps a child feel innately secure as they go through life, which is very important, really important. That's the best foundation for loving kindness or compassion.
Yeah. Mm. Boy, and we're in such a tough world, aren't we? Where being able to cultivate that seems quite difficult.
Well, I mean, that's why a lot of people go into therapy, but I think Sotni's brilliance is in seeing that meditation practice, instead of being a place to hide from these things, can be a place where you deal with them.
Mm. Right. Why we meditate.
Yeah, that's there one good reason.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Let's turn to the his thoughts around what he calls essence love, which could also be unconditional love. But maybe it'd be good for you to characterize what he's talking about.
I think his essence love is very similar to Ram Dass's loving awareness. Mm. Actually, it's an awareness which is not conditional, which just loves people as they are, which is compassionate, which means that a person's not ego-bound, but they can be open to the needs of others, and they can be caring and concerned about those needs. That's compassion.
Hmm. So I think back to our time with Neem Karoli Baba and being quite young in our early 20s for most of us. Some of us were older, like Ram Dass. And encountering that non-polarized place, I would call it, where there's no us and them in this being, and there was just a pool of that you could enter into by virtue of just being in that presence, that essence love was a good way to state. I mean, sure. You know, just oh, how yeah. we, you know, what we felt. I mean, well, what was your experience?
So I think Maharaja Neem Karoli Baba was kind of stabilized in essence love. He was just there. Mm. And you felt that aura when you were with him. And it was contagious, I think. Our friend Larry Brilliant put it really nicely. He said, the miracle wasn't that he loved us, but that when we were with him, we loved each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Extraordinary, really.
Yeah.
So the reality that we had, how should I say it, a real rudder for the rest of our lives to be able to understand beyond intellect what that unconditionality was. I mean, when I say this a billion times, when I first met Ram Dass, the day that I met him and we were just alone in this house that he was staying in Montreal, and there was this sense of, I'm not here for Richard or Ram Dass. There's just a pool here that we can be, and whatever you need is available. And it created this trust, intuitive trust, that led me to go to India at that time. And I understood the reality, of course, of what was happening in that moment. Once I met Neem Karoli Baba, then I understood, oh, shit, that's what Ram Dass was about.
Oh, this is it.
Yeah. And it's interesting because people would say, well, you got there, you got right in it, and now what's the problem? What's the problem, right? After all these years, decades, you know, what is the problem with you still having neurotic stuff going on, and you haven't transformed those habitual patterns, and it's called a life, right? And I just think Tokni equates this essence love. One of the ways in which he characterizes it is okayness, a certain okayness, oh, right? Nice. Do you remember him talking about that?
Yes. That's the felt sense of having essence love or being in essence love. This sense of I'm okay, okayness, not just with myself, but with things as they are.
Very important, right thing, with things
being
as
reactive,
they are.
It's equanimity, I think.
Yeah.
And that's one of the signs of this. And I think it's one of the signs that a being has kind of found their way into essence love and stayed there. One of the, I don't know how to put this, but, you know, having been with Neem Karoli Baba gives you a North Star. Gives you
rudder,
a sense of what to aspire to.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean you're instantly there where he is. This is
unfortunately as well, by the way.
This is why I got interested in meditation. I went to Bodh. Did you go to Bodh Gaya?
No, I wasn't in Bodh Gaya with you. I went later. I was in Sri Aurobindo Ashram where you all were.
Oh, okay. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But many people in the Neem Karoli Satsang ended up in Bodh Gaya studying Vipassana, which is where mindfulness comes from. My feeling was that I wanted to work with my own mind and bring it somewhere nearer to where Ngkoli Baba's mind was. And that seemed to be a path that might go there. I think that one reason that I've been happy studying with Sopni and his family is that I think that this is a well-established pathway to that loving awareness or to that sense of okayness or mind essence.
Mm. I love that word. Just okayness, you know. Yeah. People have trouble with love and what's essence, what does that mean? But right. Okayness, we all understand.
Exactly.
We can be there. That can happen.
And you know, I think we're all there from time to time, moment to moment. The question is, can we be there more? Can we be there in our relationships? Can we be there in our most difficult relationships? Can we be there when we're alone? Can we stabilize? These are all aspirational.
Yeah, no, absolutely. By the way, you talk about Tara's book, Danny's wife. Whoever's doing the show notes here, let's make sure we get that book into a connective tissue for people to be able to find it on in the podcast.
It's called Emotional Alchemy. Yeah.
Mm. Where is she? We should bring her into this right now. So he goes further into in talking about essence love. He talks about the expression of love, you know, which is directed outward, and everybody is way familiar with, you know, what that means, you know, related to romantic love and parental love and so on. I think I remember either doing something with Ram Dass with a few other people at some retreat or something like that, where we talked about, you know, people were dismissing romantic love or the love of parental love or friendship love as that's not the thing. The thing is completely, it's got to be unconditional love or it's nothing. But isn't it true? The reality is all love has in it a kernel, a seed of that essence love. Is that not true?
That's very nicely put. And I think that all of them are on the same spectrum. It's all love. But I think that the defining difference or a way to think of progress along that spectrum toward essence love is the degree of ego clinging. I love you because you love me, for example. Or I just love you. Those are two very different statements. Different ways of expressing love.
Yeah. I mean, he talks about, this is something I haven't heard this term before, with the opposite of essence love being hollowness. That's an interesting concept. Talk about that.
Well, with essence love, you have that sense of okayness, which means you're fine as you are. The sense of hollowness is that no matter what you have, no matter how much money, how much fame, or how many lovers you have, you feel empty inside. It's not enough. So that's a kind of a inner desperation, the hollowness. And I think it also is too common in modern life. You know, sometimes people feel it as loneliness. Sometimes they feel it as a yearning for something that they can't quite name, no matter what they get and no matter what they have. I have a friend who is a wealth advisor. That means he tells rich people how to manage their money. And he knows many, many wealthy people. And he is advocating something he calls true wealth, which is not being able to make a lot of money, but having friends, having rich relationships, having a spiritual life. In other words, not defining yourself by one strand of success, but by having a fuller life in itself.
A little bit unusual for the money manager, I don't know, wealth manager.
Yeah, well, good luck to him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That would be revolutionary if that could start a trend. But either he or Sokni or you talk about memories of unconditional love. I've always thought, and I've said to people whenever we've had this kind of a discussion, particularly if they say, well, you've met Neem Karoli, Bob, you've met great teachers in one way or another, but are those teachers available? Well, they are. Here's someone like Sokni who's available, and his whole family.
Sure. Many great teachers come to the West pretty regularly.
Yeah. So that's possible. But I always say it's a matter of tuning into that intuitive trust place. And how can that happen? That can happen because it's first of all, it's not necessarily physical, although yes, you can get a transmission from a physical teacher. But you know, you might have heard a piece of music and that suddenly put you into a state where you were not polarized. There wasn't that me and them kind of thing going on, or read a book, or you just saw Krishna, or you know, be at a Krishnadas chant concert, and suddenly a moment. I mean, I've heard people, I have so many people actually had no idea about chanting or anything, just happened. Somebody dragged them into one of his things, his concerts. And then he would do what's called the Hanuman Chalisa, 40 verses in praise of the monkey god, you know, which is, part of our whole legacy. They'd never heard it before. And then suddenly they find themselves deeply weeping or deeply absorbed. These kinds of things, psychedelics, of course, is another major way. These kinds of things get integrated in your being, and they're a resource for that intuitive trust. Wow, I have experienced it. It is real, and I can relate with it in different situations as I go forward. I mean, true.
Well, I think the most valuable part of such experiences, as you eloquently describe them, is that you now know there's more than ordinary awareness. There's more than normal consciousness. There are other possibilities that have their own kind of richness, and there are paths to those possibilities. The reason I like and continue to like meditation is that it's a well-worn path toward a more lasting sense of exactly what you're describing.
And I think it's said in here that these moments trigger what Sokni calls essence love. Any of these moments, and they can be casual.
But he also says, I don't know if he says it in this book, but he does say that these moments give us a glimpse of what's possible. They don't stabilize us in that. It's not like we're there forever. I think we need to work on our minds to do that.
Do you remember, Krishnadas told me this, that Maharaji said to some Westerners at one time, I've done everything for you. I leave you the mind. And everyone, there was a collective, oh, God. But here we are, right? And this is what this book represents, us dealing with the mind and using meditative and other perspective practices.
Exactly. What's interesting to me is that the satsang, who were those who were originally, Westerners who were originally with Neem Karoli Baba, each have found their own path and, you know, their own reality about this. And, you know, if you ask 20 satsang members what to do, you'll get 25 responses for sure. There's no uniformity, no one thing.
You know, I would say, though, I mean, obviously the classic representation of the path of bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion, is there, you know? And
I think that's a commonality. Absolutely.
That's a commonality, yeah. You know what the other commonality is to me, Danny, is the power of discriminative wisdom, which emanating from Buddhist perspective. I mean, look at all those, you know, the retreats that we used to have in Maui. Well, we still do, actually. Mm-hmm. And now we're doing one in Boone, North Carolina as well. They all always had, and this was, you know, certainly Ram Dass's input, very much so. Most of his friends, his deep, close friends, aside from the people he was in India with Neem Karoli Baba, with Maharaji, were Buddhist. Well, Roshi Joan Halifax, you know, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, on and on and on. Right. So there was a place in which it felt comfy for him to have these people there. And then whenever he would start talking about soul. And then as soon as he mentioned the word, he'd look over next to him at one of the Buddhist teachers, like, oh, I'm so sorry that I mentioned. They would laugh. So, but the truth is, most of us did go through that Vipassana training, even if many of us perhaps did not follow through with it. Mm. It's been a stable thing for me all of these decades, and I think for many people. But the discriminating wisdom part of it, I think, is a real asset on the spiritual path. There's that famous story. Krishnadas and I, he had a bum knee, and we were in Vrindavan and were told, don't come to see Maharaji at the ashram there. But he said, listen, you got to help me. I got to get over there. I don't know what to do. I'm in such pain. So we went over there and we sat down with him. And, it's a famous thing where Maharaji got up and went across the courtyard and started limping. And Krishna said to me, I bet he's going to help me out. And he did. And then he sat down, never said a word about it. And then Krishnadas had his diary, and he had written some passage from Mahamudra, famous Buddhist text. And Maharaji had the translator translate a few lines of it. And when he did, he went, teak. That's right. Uh-huh. And then flipped the page, and there was a big picture of him. And he said to us, who's that? And we were going, yeah, you're just jiving us, you know. And we said, it's you. He said, nay, Buddha. That has stuck with both of us, forever. Yeah. And the highest praise he ever gave about other quote-unquote saints, teachers, or whatever, were Tibetans.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I do know that, according to Girija, another satsang member, the 16th Karmapa, who is very highly esteemed Tibetan, said of Ning Kroli, he's a Mahasiddha.
Yeah, I heard that.
Which is the highest praise. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there seems to be a convergence of the Buddhist path and this version of bhakti.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. We don't have much time left, but I love it. There's some little phrases that he comes up with, Tokni. And this one's called California Compassion. I love that. It is so right on, but it's under a chapter called Willingness to Suffer. Now, here's something that we are not very good at. At all, as much as I think Maharaji said, suffering brings grace, basically. Yeah, but it's a difficult thing. Talk about that.
Well, everyone wants to avoid suffering.
Yeah.
But people who suffer can learn great compassion. I think that's what that refers to. California compassion. Remind me what he means by that.
Oh, he was saying, I like to tease people who would live in California because it's so beautiful. Here I am sitting in Ojai, California, like talk about lovely and beautiful. He said, one night a spiritual man living in California was getting ready for bed. He lit some incense and did a few minutes of compassion, quote unquote, compassion meditation before climbing under his soft organic sheets. Oh, I wish I, is he in this country right now?
No, he's in Nepal right
he's
now.
He's in Nepal.
Yeah, he's native Nepal. He has a base, he has a monastery there.
Uh-huh.
And another, right. Yeah.
And his brother, Mingyur, also has one in Nepal, in Kathmandu.
Yeah, very close to him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. He wanted to feel fresh and look good the next morning, so it worked. So he was looking towards a beautiful, restful sleep.
Right.
But then the phone rang, and a friend was really sick and asked the man could take her to the hospital. He took a deep breath. Part of him wanted to be the kind of person who did that. But he also he really wanted to sleep well and feel fresh in the morning. The desire for good rest won, and he apologized in a soothing voice. That's so funny. And said he couldn't do it, but he really hoped she found someone to take her. Really hoped she felt better. That's California compassion for you.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Exactly.
Oh, God, we are something. No.
Krishnadas just came back from a retreat with Garchen Rinpoche.
Yeah, yeah.
Garchen Rinpoche is quite an old, I think he's in his 80s now.
Yeah.
He was in a Chinese concentration camp for 20 years.
I know. I actually was fortunate to meet him. Yeah. Maybe 15 years ago. I actually was his driver when he was teaching in Los Angeles.
Then you know he radiates compassion.
Yeah.
Having gone through deep, deep, unbelievable suffering.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, where does it come from with these people, the Tibetans?
Well, he had a practice, which was to see his own suffering in an almost Christ-like way as atoning for everyone's sins, including his own, and to be compassionate even toward his torturers, because they were human beings too. Now, that's an amazingly difficult and powerful kind of practice to have. And the situation he was in, it gave him too many chances to practice it, all too many. Yeah.
He met his guru in prison, right?
Garchen.
Oh, boy. Anyhow, there's so much more in here. We could go on for quite some time. This book is just chock full of helpful stuff. So everybody listening, I highly recommend it. I've actually, in recent past, I mean, I see a lot of books come across because publishers are sending me stuff for people to do podcasts all the time. And this book is as notable to me as Pema Chodron, How We Live is How We Die. That I actually went to India. Gee, we haven't even talked. Yeah, I was in India last October sitting in front of Trishul. And I was just around where you were, where we were in Kosani.
Oh, really?
Right, and you had that little cottage. We were up in the Gandhi ashram, and you had the cottage below with Anasuya.
Yeah,
I was right. I found a place just a mile down the road or something, smack in front of Trishul and the whole arc of the Himalayas.
That's a whole other conversation, which I hope we have one day.
Yes, we will. So I highly recommend this in the same way that I recommended Pema Chodron's book.
And thank you.
Thank you for putting this together with Sokni. And I hope actually to meet him one day. I hope to try and keep track of when that Krishnadas told me he's giving a retreat at the end of August or something.
Actually, he's changed it to fall.
Oh, really?
September, I think.
Oh.
Oh, no, right, no. Well, he had to cancel that. It's going to be in April now.
April 24.
I don't know the date. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's worth doing. He's one of those great teachers who comes to the West regularly, and anyone who wants to meet a great teacher.
There you go.
Sign up. There
yeah.
you go.
No,
there
absolutely.
Are many. Luckily.
Yeah. 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 That's so great. So great to see you and hang out,
pleasure.
Danny. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Yeah, everybody, this is Mind Rolling on the Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. And Danny and my friends are all over that network. So enjoy, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you.